And then we saw that they weren't tied supposed to be. And here's the first thing I want to draw your attention to, that when chapter 10, when they made this covenant of revival, it says, the sons of Israel and the sons of Levi shall bring the contribution of the grain, the new wine, the oil of the chambers, and the utensils. So in other words, they're promising to do the tithing. It says, we will not neglect the house of the Lord. All right? Well, that's an oath. 10 years later, what does Nehemiah say? Why is the house of God? The very thing they promised to do, 10 years is not a long time, is it? So it's interesting. We've made promises in our own life. We made commitments. Well, I'm going to do this. And whether it's lose weight at the beginning of the year, or it's going to read the Bible, or come to every service, whatever it is, how long does it take for us to kind of just wander away from our promise and commitment? Well, that's not going to be the first one. He restores all the ties. And that's where we saw in chapter 13 and verse 14, this first prayer of Nehemiah, and there's three of them here in this chapter, where he's asking God to remember him. So we're in verse 14. Remember me for this, oh my God, and do not blot out my loyal deeds, which I have performed for the house of my God in his services. So after restoring the ties, he asks for God to remember him. Now, is this a selfish prayer? Well, of course not. Is it okay to ask God to reward you and honor you? Yes. And we quoted the scripture of Hebrews 11, verse 6 last week, where it said, "Impossible, please God." But you got to, everyone that comes to God must believe that he is. But also you got to believe that he is a rewarder. And so, remember me, Lord. Now, also what's interesting, he says, do not blot out my loyal deeds. Now, if you've been in my classes, you know we make a big deal about the word chesed. It's that C-H-E-S-D word right there. And it's a word that speaks of God's covenant love. New American Standard translated most often loving kindness. It's this loyalty that keeps you bound to someone. That's why it's called covenant love. That no matter what they do, you're going to be faithful. And it really describes who God is. And here he says, do not blot out my loyal deeds. That's actually this word here, said. And it's interesting. So he's saying, remember me and remember what I have done for you, being honorable or truthful to your word. And so later he's going to make a different request. Now, we won't look at Malachi again, but there is a book of remembrance. Remember that for our deeds? So that's what's really interesting. God is intimately aware of what you do and what you don't do for that matter. That's why Romans chapter 14, verse 10 says, everyone will give an account of himself or herself for the deeds done in the flesh. You won't give an account for your mom, your dad, your spouse, your children. The only one you'll give an account for is yourself. And God remembers, he's not so unjust that he would forget your service to the Lord. Whether everyone else does, whether you're recognized by anyone else, it doesn't matter, because we don't do it to be, do we? But it's okay if you want God to make, you know, I'm being faithful to you. Well, this idea of remembrance is found several times in the book of Nehemiah. In fact, we're going to look at several of them here. First of all, in chapter 5, verse 19, remember me, my God, for good, according to all that I've done for this people. Now, has he been an effective leader? Yeah, built a wall in 52 days, overcome all the obstacles. And he says, remember me for what I've done for this people. And then we see in chapter 6, verse 14, remember, oh my God, Tobiah and Sanballat. Now, what were they at that time? They were adversaries, right? Trying to destroy the work of Nehemiah. Remember them according to the works of theirs, because they're trying to frighten me. So on both ends, does God remember the good things you do? And is it fair to ask him to be just and judge the people for the evil they do? There's a lot of times I don't understand why what happens to the world happens. You know, that shooter down in Texas, you know, obviously has mental problems, but you just do not understand. But is God going to take care of it all in the end? And that's going to be our faith. And that's his prayer. Remember these two evil people. Isn't that what he's saying? He said, well, that's not very kind. Well, yes, it is. God's a God of justice. And there's never peace in our own life unless we see there's going to be justice, right? And so it's fair to ask. And then in chapter 13, where we are right now, remember me for my loyal deeds. Now we're going to see two more in verse 22 and then verse 29. And then actually three more. So we'll look at all those when we get there. But now he's going to discover or see that they're breaking the Sabbath. Now what? On the Sabbath, someone tell me real quickly. Okay, what day was it? Saturday. When did it start? Friday evening. That's when their day started, when the sun went down. And what was the law of the Sabbath? You have to rest. That means you what? Couldn't do what? No work. What was the definition of work? They couldn't even cook that day. They had to cook the night before. It was a total day of rest, thanking God for all the bountiful blessings. And it's one day you can stop from working for yourself and just honor God and rest. And it's healthy to do that, but God asked them to do that. So do you know work when you see work? Yeah, if a guy's trading, if he's selling things, if he's got his little booth up, you know work when you see work. And so this is what... Remember how many days they spent reading the law? Were they aware of the Sabbath? So can you understand why he's upset? Verse 15. In those days I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath. In other words, they're making grapes into wine. Bringing in sacks of grain, loading them on donkeys, as well as wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads. And they brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. So I admonished them on the day they sold food. And also men of Tyre were living there who imported fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them as the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. So then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, what is this evil thing you're doing by profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do the same so that God brought on us all... on the city, all this trouble. Yet you are adding to the wrath of Israel by profaning the Sabbath. Now, there's the section. It's really going to be an issue of priorities. And we've been following this theme that there's permissiveness that have crept in, right? And first there was permissiveness. Last week we saw in finances, they weren't tithing or giving. Here is that. Man, we could just make some more money if we worked Saturday, right? And we could get some business done. And, you know, there's just so much to do. And I'm going to give some to the Lord anyway. Can you imagine how the justification comes? And it's so easy to fall into this trap, but it's really a matter of priority, especially when we go back to chapter 10 and verse 31. As for the people of the land who brings wares or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath. Have they already made a commitment? They already made a promise to God? Now, 10 years later, people of Tyre are bringing in their fish and they're selling and they're trading the donkey. He says, we won't do it on the Sabbath, their holy day, and we'll forgo the crops the seventh year and the exaction of the debt. So they had already made a promise to honor the Sabbath. 10 years, they have slid into this apostasy. Yes. Yeah.
I'll just transport it in.
Yeah, okay.
That's you know.
And these guys are in town for a little while. I got to get it now, you know. And
well, but it's there, and then the next day I can sell it. But, you know, so they just slowly.
Sure. Oh, I'll sell on Sunday, but I got to take in the inventory on Saturday. Right.
Yeah, or bring it in.
Right. And they already promised we're not going to do that. You just don't. You rest means what? Rest. Now, it's interesting, he admonished them the day they sold food. Did you ever hear of the blue laws that used to exist in our state? Some exist still in the book today, but this is from Virginia in 1610. And I'll a secretary in the United States of America regarding Sunday and your work on Sunday, man and woman. On Sabbath, in their mind was Sunday. They're thinking Sunday somehow being the Sabbath. For the first and for the balance, what? If you didn't keep Sunday worship and rest, what was the law? Third offense, you're dead. Three strikes, you're out. You go, what? Many cities, many counties, and many states that made it illegal to open up a shop for commerce on Sunday. And it's all because they understood that was the day of worship. They were called blue laws, and I don't understand for exactly why they're called blue laws, all right? Have things changed since that? All right? I didn't want to do that. Here are some alcohol sales that are still not, you can't purchase alcohol on Sundays in these states. It used to be every state. What's interesting is this one right here. Which one is that? No, right there. Oh, that's Utah. Yeah, and there's Nevada, right? And that's Montana. And then, of course, in the Bible Belt, you see a lot of that.
Well, Georgia just passed. Georgia.
Oh, now you can sell alcohol?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's still there. Now you say, well, is this constitutional?
Yes.
Well, many times the U.S. Constitution, the federal court has ruled that these blue laws are lawful if the states want to invoke them. And so this is the statement from Chief Justice Stephen Johnson, and this is from many years ago, 1896. Its requirement is a cessation from labor. That's these blue laws. It's, and in its enactment, the legislator has given the sanction of the law to the rule of conduct, which the entire civilized world recognizes as essential. What are they talking about? Resting on Sunday and going to worship. He says, the whole world realizes it's essential to the physical and moral well-being of society. Upon no subject is there such a concurrence of opinion among philosophers, moralists, statesmen of all nations, as on the necessity of periodical cessation from labor. One day in seven is a rule, found in experience, is sustained by science. I didn't know that. And this prohibition of secular business on Sunday is advocated on the ground that by it, the general welfare is advanced, labor protected, and the moral and physical well-being of society pronounced. So what he's saying is, stop working and start resting. Now, when I grew up, you couldn't buy anything on Sunday. Sometimes it was hard finding a gas station that was open. Then all of a sudden, the grocery store is open. Then all of a sudden, more gas stations. Then slowly, other stores would open after in the afternoon. And then after a while, they're open all day long. It used to be Wednesday night, nothing happened, but now there's activities for our youth on Wednesday night, because it used to be that no sporting events, no school events, because everyone went to midweek worship or Bible study. Now you're competing with, has our nation become very secularized? Now, it doesn't matter. The only reason I bring this up is it healthy for us just to stop?
Yeah.
Just stop. You know, we work, we're so busy, we're just running every which direction. Just stop. And stop on Sunday and just take some time and worship God. Go out and spend some time with your brothers and sisters or with your family and say, well, can I work in the afternoon? I guess just make a commitment to stop, just rest. You can start tomorrow, Monday, to work again and start making money. It's okay. In fact, I would challenge you that God will bless you if you just take some time off and remember Him. Now, it's interesting. The Sabbath law of the Jews was punishable by death if you broke it. Do Christians have any kind of command like that? No. It's all from the heart. It's all an attitude, isn't it? Where you're just choosing to make a priority and saying, you know, it's just time enough. I'm enough during the week to do all my things. We're just going to slow down. I think we'd have a healthier life, a better family life, probably more calmness, better relationships with God. All right? So they restored the Sabbath, and that's what they did. He called it an evil thing, the profaning the Sabbath. And it's interesting, verse 18 reminds you, you know why we got down alone in captivity? You realize why we've had all these problems? It's because things like this, we weren't keeping God's law. He's reminding them. And at one time, back in chapter 10, they wept. Remember the law was being read? And they made this commitment, we'll keep the Sabbath, we'll tithe. 10 years, they're back doing business. How quickly does it take a church to slide into some type of apostasy? 10 years or even less. And it happens just ever so slowly, ever so slowly. And we once could be a vibrant church, and then you could be a dead church. All right? So there it is. So he shuts the gates, doesn't let people come in. I commanded that the doors should be shut. They don't open them until after the Sabbath. No load would enter on the Sabbath. And he actually put guards, you know, to guard the way. And then he says, they actually were sleeping outside the wall, just waiting for the door to open. He says, I will use force against you. Man, Nehemiah is a real leader here, isn't he? He's just being very, some would say, radical about it. From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. And I command Levites, they should purify themselves and come as gatekeepers to save the Sabbath day. So, is it appropriate for us to admonish one another, to sometimes reprove one another? Now, which one's stronger, admonish or reprove? Reprove seems to be the hard word. Then the other word the Bible uses, rebuke. That's even stronger. You can exhort, admonish. You know, exhort is like encourage. Admonish, like, come on, you can do this. You know you should be doing it. Reprove is to reprove them. Remember, you made a commitment. You decided to follow Christ. No one forced you to become a Christian. And you made a commitment for your life. Now, come on, let's go. Now, rebuke is stronger yet, right? It's almost like shame. But it's not my job to shame anyone. It's them. It's to point out the shame they have before God because they're not keeping their commitment to Him. They're not keeping their priority. But it's hard to do, isn't it? Nehemiah did it. I wonder if his popularity went up as high as it was when he completed the wall in 52 days, or did it start to plummet? He comes back down and after 10 years, and he's just cleaning house, one thing after another. I don't know, it doesn't say, does it? But after each time, he goes back to God and says, God, remember me. And that just gives me a feeling that he feels alone. No one can understand what he's doing and maybe are supporting him. And so he just goes back to God and says, God, remember me for my loyal deeds. I'm just doing it for you. Yes.
I think we get a little of what it is that when he says, I will lay my hand on
you. Yeah.
I think that's an insight that his popularity is going down because, I mean, if you're the governor of a city,
yeah,
you're not doing anything, really. I mean, he didn't go out with it doesn't say he went out with a horde of his people or anybody. It just, he went out.
Yeah. And maybe it's how serious he's taking it, that I will do this. I'm not going to send someone else. I'll do it myself. All right. So, you know, is that kind of commitment necessary to make anything work? A marriage, a business, getting a four-year education in college? That kind of commitment? Well, spiritually, it's even more important. All right. So, in verse 22, and this is his prayer. For this also remember me, that this refers to restoring the Sabbath. It says, oh my God, and have compassion on me. Now that's it. I think into his mindset. have compassion on me, because maybe he's feeling a little vulnerable here. Maybe a little alone or insecure. But he says, do it according to the greatness of your loving kindness. Now, I have the little star, and guess what word that is? It's his first prayer. Remember me because of my covenant love. I've been faithful to you. Look at my deeds. Now, God, please remember me. Please remember me because of your covenant love. Don't forget me. See how it switched? It's like, God, I'm doing this for the second time. Lord, be faithful out of your love for me. Have you been on both sides, confident sometimes, and sometimes a little weak and feeling alone? But is God a God of covenant love, of loving kindness? He will show loving kindness, he says, to the thousandth generation, to those who love him and keep his commandments. You know, his loving kindness will never fail. All right? That's what he's known for. So that's verse 22. Now we're going to see there's permissiveness that invades the personal relationships, specifically marriage. Ezra did with this as well. But let's read the section in verse 23. In those days, I also saw. So I just wanted you to see, look in verse 10. I discovered, see that? In verse 15, I saw. And now in verse 23, he sees something else. He's just discovering, uncovering these sins of the people. I saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. As for their children, half spoke in the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people. So I contended with them and cursed them. That's not, you know, bad language. It's calling them under an oath for God, under God. And struck some of them and pulled out their hair. Now that is pretty severe, and made them swear by God, you shall not give your daughters to your sons, nor take of their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. Now, why did he make them to swear to do that? It's almost word for word.
They already had done that.
Well, that's what they've been doing. Why did he make them swear they wouldn't? Because that's what the law dictated. And he's saying, be true to the law. It's not being true to Nehemiah. Be true to God. Because he's the one that said, don't do that. Now, verse 26, he invokes probably the greatest example of why you shouldn't do this. And who is that? And they all knew it. Solomon. Didn't Solomon, king of Israel, sin regarding these things? And he asked for not riches, not power, but for wisdom. God said, I'll give them more than anyone. I'm going to make you really rich. Well, he was pretty wise, but he was pretty foolish in his actions because he married all sorts of women. We'll look at that in a second. And they turned his heart away from his God because that's what a woman will do often. Well, come on, just worship my God with your God. What's the big deal? And don't you love me? And it was that kind of thing. And pretty soon he's worshiping idols alongside with Jehovah. So, did not like him, and he was loved by God, made him king over all of Israel. Isn't that do we this greatly against our God? See, it wasn't against Nehemiah. Their unfaithfulness was against God by marrying four women. Even one of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite, so I drove him away from me. So let's look at this and kind of break it down. Because now they're allowed this intermarriage to take place. And remember, in chapter 10 and verse 30, they had already made a commitment to tithe, to keep the Sabbath, and here's another one. Here's their commitment. We will not give our daughters to people of the land or take their daughters for ourselves. 10 years, what are they doing? Marrying. Even the son of the high priest, his son, married a foreign wife, the high priest in his family. If anyone that should have known better, should have been him. Now, when you look at that, it says they married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Now, when Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs, the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard the repair of the walls went on and the breaches began to close, they were very angry. Who were these individuals? Enemies of Nehemiah. And now what are they doing 10 years later? Marrying. How do you go from enemies to now we're in-laws? And it's not because the world has changed and all of a sudden become more godly. I promise you that. It's because God's people have compromised and become more like the world. Isn't that what's happened? Now, let's just be very clear. Is God being racist when he says you can't marry a foreigner? Say no. What is his reason very clearly for him saying to the Jews, you cannot marry outside the Jewish nation? It's just to keep them faithful to God. Because he knew time after time it would happen that when you marry foreigners, they're not going to give up their gods, and then you're going to end up compromising your faith. And it happened. Now, there's an exception of a Moab whose name was who? Ruth. Who married Ruth? Boaz. What's the difference? She converted or proselyted. She became, your God will be my God. Your people will be my people, right? So you could become, marry a foreigner if they became a Jew, all right? So God's not a racist. He's trying to protect your faith.
And
yeah. That's right. That's right. She said she had to keep the nation pure so the promise to Abraham through his seed, Jesus, would come. So they couldn't be so. It's interesting. The children spoke the language of Ashdod. Boy, that's a sermon. Speaking the language of Ashdod. You know, and what's that? Well, we like the world and less like Christ. More like the world and less like Christ. You know, there's one thing, I don't understand a lot of the lingo today. I'm talking about slang. That's not vulgar or anything. I just don't understand it because you can't keep up with it. I got lost when they said, man, sick. You know? It's good, right? I caught that one, then the rest, I've just lost it, right? So, but our youth, our age did it too, right? Generation. But on the other hand, there is language of the world that is vulgar, it is crude, it's ungodly, whether it's in the sexual realm or just the way we talk about people or things. And here, it's speaking specifically of speaking a foreign language. They didn't even know the Hebrew tongue. That's sad, because they're Hebrew people and they couldn't even, the children could not even speak their native language. But for Christians, the concern is we don't know the language of Christ. You know, we don't know his thoughts aren't our thoughts, and we think more like the world than less like Christ. And that's the language of Ashdod. It's really what it is. Yes?
In worship, they would not understand what the priests were saying.
Yeah, if it was in Hebrew, right.
Which?
Yeah. I'm sorry? All right. So they were... And none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people. See, isn't that sad how bad it got? So these enemies now become in-laws. And it's just, that's the way Satan worms his way into the church. And so when we look at this, God had already commanded a long time ago, but look at the action he takes. There's an explosion outwardly by Nehemiah. He contended, he cursed, he struck, he pulled out hair, made them kind of crude. But I want you to see the contrast with the implosion of Ezra. Because Ezra's living during the same time. He had to deal with the same issue. And he didn't go outward, he went inward. When he heard that they were intermarrying, I tore my tunic and cloak, pulled hair from my head and beard, and sat down appalled. And people gathered around him. What is it, Ezra? He's pulling out his hair. Why? A sign of grief and great mourning. And it's, you know, the ripping your clothes is a sign of protest and sadness, right? And it drew attention to what he was protesting about. Now, Nehemiah does the opposite. It's this right now. So with that being said, what does this pulling out hair have to do? Make a connection. Is it mean here? What is the connection? I want you to put those two together. Think, what did Ezra do? Yes.
Correct, but hair was glorifying, right?
I'm saying that again.
So,
I think it's of the men he's pulling out.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, so why was Ezra pulling out his own hair? Protest, grief, sadness. So why would Nehemiah pull out your hair if you were Marian? You should be just like Ezra. You should recognize what a terrible evil you've done, and the path you're leading this nation down, you should be pulling out your hair, and I'm going to do it for you. See? Now, I think that's what he's trying to get him to see. Now, would that get the point across real quick? Yeah, let's start right now. Now, they made it in the book of Ezra, you can read it, chapter 9, 10, 11, that they put away their foreign wives. They divorced them. That was their act of faithfulness. They said, you're right, we're going to put them away right now. Now, I don't know if they continually financially took care of their children, but they did divorce the wives because they were trying to honor God. That was drastic action. And it was prompted by this outburst. Explosion, implosion. See the difference? You need both. You need people that are weeping and mourning and fasting. And then you need people that are going to take action and get things changed. All right? Nehemiah has a position to do it. Not everyone does, though. All right? Any thoughts about that?
Well, Nehemiah was the same way as far as implosion because the times he spent in prayer,
he had personally,
he did
both.
That's right. Of his frustration with how they decline.
Yeah. It's got to bug you inside before you're going to act outside. And if you act outside without being bugged and inside, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. Does that make sense? These two got to come together. You just hurt for God, and that's why you'll act. You hurt for God. All right? So when we see that, he brings up Solomon, that they cause him to sin. Acting unfaithfully against God. You're hurting God because we're first of all married to him. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1 is the reference. We find that King Solomon loved many foreign wives along with the daughter of Pharaoh, the Moabite, the Ammonite, the Edomite, the Sidonian, and Hittite women. What did they come out of? What was their product of?
They were peace treaties.
They're political peace treaties, and the kings would say, you know, to seal our marriage, our peace, you can take my daughter as your wife. So he'd collect all these wives, right? And I'm sure they're all beautiful, right? How many wives did he end up with? 700 and 300 concubines. Yes.
Faith in God.
Yep. That's right. He promised that, didn't he?
Yeah. And they didn't need to make all of these treaties.
And actually, it worked in the opposite. He said, if you're faithful to me, none of your enemies will bother you. But if you compromise your faith, your enemies will take you away. And so by doing this, it got the opposite of peace, didn't it? They got war. Yes?
Well, King Solomon's also a remnant of the original Israelites not following the command of God and destroying the people of Canaan. First place.
Yeah.
If they had done their job in the first place, that whole generation, God wouldn't have wiped them out.
Yeah.
But all those people wouldn't have been around for Solomon to marry.
Oh, yeah. That's right. They should have got rid of all of them. That's right. So here, verse 29. He goes back to prayer to God and said, remember me. Oh, my God, because they have defiled the priesthood. That's because even the high priest's family and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites said, remember me. I'm doing this for you. I was listening to Tommy Peeler, and this is what he said. There are certain things you can recover from in life. You can recover from taking a bad job. Isn't that right? And I think he might have said a couple other things. You can recover from a bad purchase or a bad car. But there's one thing you cannot recover from. It will damage, change you for the rest of your life. And that's picking the wrong person to marry.
Amen.
And I said, wow, that's interesting. You know, because it's true. And they should have known that. But let's fast forward to Christianity. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Paul talks about we live in a different world because the Gentiles, they weren't Jews, right? And so you have two people, they're married and they're both Gentiles. The wife hears Paul preaching and she becomes a Christian, right? So now what do we have? A believer married to a non-believer. Is that okay? Yes. I mean, you love him. As long as he consents to live with him. You know, because you can win him to the Lord just by your proper and good behavior. That's 1 Peter 3. And so, but it's a divided marriage. You can't nothing do about it. That's fine. And the same way, the husband sometimes would become a believer and the wife wouldn't. So it's different. This doesn't apply to those scenarios. You with me? But for Christians, we have a choice who we're going to marry. And we talked about that earlier, and I just want parents, talk to your children. Talk to your children. It's a choice they can't take back. And we could talk about the divorce rate nowadays, and it's just not good. And it's harder for two Christians to make it now sometimes. But the odds get even worse when you're marrying someone that has a whole different value system. Remember them. Who does he ask and you remember now? Not me. Hey. Them. Who's the them? The priests and all the leaders of the Jewish people, because they've been unfaithful. Remember them. Is that for good or for bad? Remember what the bad. Bring justice. They've led your people astray by their example. All right. So, thus, he says, I purified them from everything foreign, appointed duties for the priests and the Levites, each in his task, and arranged for the supply of wood at the appointed times for the first fruits. And here's how he signs off. Remember me, oh my God, for good. And that'd be your last, that'd be something fine to say. God, remember me for the good that I did for you. Wouldn't that be nice? Someone could say that. And for the good they did for the Lord. That's all I can say. The good they did. I mean, that's all you want for, right? It's not for being a great business person, or good looking, or a great athlete, or what. There's no higher compliment than saying, man, when I think of them, I think of the good they did for the Lord. Right? Yes. That's right. He was an amazing leader. Let's review his leadership. And he had this heart of a servant heart. First of all, in this chapter alone, we see he discovered and acknowledged the problem. So if you want to help and do good, we see that he learned, he discovered, he saw. A lot of people don't want to acknowledge the problem that the problem that's in front of them. They'll have to do something, right? And they have to acknowledge that there's a problem. It's hard to deal with it for some people. Because that means I have to change, right? Fix it. So let's just ignore it. Maybe it'll go away. Do problems go away? No, they get worse. I could times. I've talked with people, and one spouse, the other, was drinking. Go away. It got worse. One spouse, the other, was viewing pornography, and they ignored it, and it just got worse instead of better. No, a good leader is going to acknowledge the problem, and he's going to be troubled by it. Notice the words. He was displeased. He reprimanded the officials. He admonished. He contended. Cursed. Struck. It bothered him. He couldn't go to bed without doing something about it. Because that's what leaders do. They what? They lead. They lead. You know, no matter if anyone's following or not, you're going to lead. And that's much how passionate he was about it. And the last thing, he always took action, all right? He always took action, some type of action, all right? It wasn't just talk. So there is Nehemiah. I just hope it's resonates with you, because there's so much more. It's not about building a wall, is it? There's so much about our personal life here as a Christian and just our walk with God. Here are a couple of books that you keep reading your own. Have this talk, read Nehemiah with your kids and talk about it. Read it with your friends or family. This one's by Carl Lanny. It's $5-6. It's less than it costs to eat lunch nowadays. Here's by Derek Kidner. It's a Tyndale Old Testament commentaries. This is Wilson Adams. Anyone know who he is? He does a Courageous Living series about leadership. It's a short book about, I'd encourage you to, you know, read that. Because Nehemiah is written for our, right? So. So well for the last 13 weeks.